When a parent lashes out at the other parent in front of a child, or simply says hurtful things about the other parent in front of a child, they are also attacking that child's sense of self-worth and confidence.
Dad says Mom doesn't really care about me and that she's lazy.
This is an act of alienation and is harmful to children and can cause a lifetime of issues for the child. Issues as serious as anxiety, depression, substance abuse, and thoughts of or actual suicide.
What did I do to make Mommy and Daddy so mad at each other?
Whether or not your child reaches his or her full and healthy potential in life rests in your ability to be mature and put them first.
I love you, Mom and Dad.
Help spread the word to educate and raise awareness. Visit www.paawareness.org to find out more.
Hi, this is Amy Baker.
Welcome. So nice to have you here. And Jill is here, Jill Ejizi, and so is Judge Michelle Lawrence.
Hello.
Hi, Amy. Welcome. Thanks for both of you being here tonight.
Well, I wanted to start by saying that this is the first evening for Family Matters on syndicatednews.net. Jill Ejizi is an advocate for parental alienation awareness, and she's politically active, serving as an alderman in the city of Leland Grove, Illinois. The Illinois Speaker of the House, Michael Madigan, appointed Jill to the Illinois Family Law Study Committee, whose mission is to revamp state divorce law. The book journeys into the heart and soul of parental alienation syndrome in the compelling novel. It's revealing that even in the aftermath of psychological devastation, there's hope for reconstruction through knowledge, awareness, and above all, love. Jill's also a board member of Children Need Both Parents. It's a non-for-profit organization emphasizing shared parenting. Judge Michelle Lawrence recently wrote the book The Good Karma Divorce, and it offers tried and true techniques to handling divorce with a calm sense of mind and energy. Her professional and personal experience with divorce, combined with her studies in Eastern philosophy, led her to consider the laws of karma and how to effectively apply it to the divorce process. Dr. Amy Baker is a nationally recognized expert in parent-child relationships, especially children of divorce, parental alienation syndrome, and emotional abuse of children. She has a doctorate in developmental psychology and is the director of research at the Vincent J. Fontana Center for Child Protection. Among her many publications, she's the author of Adult Children of Parental Alienation Syndrome, Breaking the Ties That Bind, and I Don't Want to Choose, How Middle School Kids Can Resist the Pressure to Choose One Parent Over the Other. Ladies, welcome.
Thanks, Ruthie. I really appreciate Michelle and Amy being here tonight. And Michelle, Amy, if I can just put you on hold for a second, I just want to talk to Michelle and make everyone aware of how we became acquainted. We were working together on a project to develop a study group of people with Dr. Jane Major out of California that would try to improve the divorce process and really change the culture and how people divorce all across this country. And we became very good friends. And then it just so happened that our books were released on the same day. And I don't think there's a better person or a better across this country than Michelle. And I'm so pleased and honored that she has decided to co-host this show with me. Thank you, Michelle.
Well, The Look of Love, your book, is so important to me. You know, I see case after case in my courtroom, alienation, even when it's not as strong as the ones that you usually talk about. There's alienating behaviors that worry me all the time. And your book really shows what happens when there's no way and no strategy for limiting and managing and really diffusing those alienating behaviors. So it really complements what I see in court, and you have gone from the beginning to the end of that spectrum in sort of the complete object lesson of what can happen for everybody.
Well, and of course, your book, Michelle, The Good Karma Divorce, is just the perfect solution to how to deal with conflict in a high conflict divorce, and you are revolutionary in your courtroom and how you deal with divorcing families and especially children.
I want to ask you, because I think you are just about one of the top experts on something that is elusive, amorphous, enigmatic, and so difficult to pin down. And unless people have a real understanding of it, people can feel very helpless and very lost. And not just in my courtroom, but, you know, friends that I have say, what can I do if one party wants to create a degeneration of the relationship between a parent and a child? Do they really have free reign?
Well, why don't we ask Amy that question?
Well, unfortunately, as I think we all know from our own perspective, it is all too easy. Basically, what an alienating parent needs is some access to the child. It doesn't even have to be 50-50, but some access to the child and a motivation to poison that child's mind against the other parent. And in my research, I found at least 17 fairly common parental alienation strategies that parents use. And these strategies create a psychological wedge between the child and the targeted parent, and if before the alienation began.
I want to know why you chose this area to study and research.
Well, it's really part of a larger program of research that I've been involved with for years on different aspects of abuse. What's so particularly interesting about this field is how pervasive the problem is and how little understood, or how easily it is for people to misunderstand. I think there's some very dangerous myths that people hold in their mind about this is something that only happens to fathers. Mothers don't lose their kids this way, and we know, of course, that's not true, but that's a myth that's out there. I think there's a belief that a good parent couldn't possibly lose their child, that children must be picking the quote-unquote better parent. And I think those of us in this field need to work to continue to break through these barriers that people have, these beliefs that get in the way of them really seeing what's going on before it's too late.
Dr. Baker, let's start from the very beginning. Let's say somebody is deciding to divorce, okay? The parents are living together. Obviously, the relationship is going through mutual distrust. Can the alienation start at that stage?
Yes, it definitely starts before the end of the marriage, and in some cases people choose to stay married and this is going on. That is another myth, that this only happens in divorce cases. That's the common, typical context, but it's not the only context.
Before you tell us, why would somebody want to alienate in an intact marriage?
The gratification of being the preferred parent. For some people, you know, if there's a parent who's narcissistic, and that is my operating assumption that parents who do this have a narcissistic or borderline personality, they need to feel special and important, and one way to do that is to enmesh the child with them and be the preferred parent.
Mm. But Amy, don't you think as well that in many intact marriages, you are saying alienating things at times without even thinking? So in an unconscious manner, you're doing exactly that without even knowing. And as we know, many people don't even know what the words parental alienation mean.
Maybe you could define that for us.
Well, I use two different terms, parental alienation strategies and parental alienation syndrome. The strategies are the parental behaviors. Those are the things that parents do that consciously or unconsciously are designed to undermine the child's relationship with the other parent. Now, not every child who's exposed to those behaviors ultimately will reject the targeted parent, either because the alienation isn't that strong, the person isn't that good at using these strategies, or because the child has sufficient critical thinking skills that he or she can see it for what it is. So not every child who's exposed to alienation becomes alienated. But when a child rejects a parent who does not deserve to be rejected, a parent that the child had a pre-existing good relationship with, those children we call alienated, as opposed to estranged, which is the term we use for kids who don't have a relationship with the parent because that parent has done something to cause the breach in the relationship.
So what are some strategies you could use in an intact marriage, for example, when you are on the verge of getting a divorce and you want to be on top of it? You want to do everything you can to try and minimize that result.
Well, the main thing, I guess there's two main things. The first is you have to be educated on what are the primary alienation strategies. I can't tell you how many times somebody emails me after they've read my list, and they're like, oh, yeah, they did. The other parent did do number 1 and 5 and 7, but I never saw it as part of, I didn't connect the dots and see that this was all part of a strategy to ruin my relationship with my child. So the first thing is you need to know what those 17 are. The most important thing is to continue to be empathic with the child, no matter how nasty and vicious that child is, no matter what they accuse you of. And sort of a classic example is what the child will say, you know, Mom says you stole my college money. I've heard four-year-olds complaining about it. They don't even know what college is. They don't even know what money is, but they're all worked up because the other parent has convinced them that the targeted parent has stolen their money. What most targeted parents do is they get angry. I did not steal your money. Or they run upstairs and they get the bank statement and they wave it in front of the kid's face. Because that's sort of human nature. Let me defend myself. Let me show you that's a wrong idea. But in cases of alienation, that does not work. What works is to say to the child, oh, my God, you think I stole your money. That must really hurt and make you angry.
Amy, you're talking about people who are lucky enough to still have a relationship with their children. And
well, the question
when
was posed to me was, what do you do if you're just beginning the divorce?
Right.
I do have some advice and suggestions for people for whom that they don't have that luxury. They don't have any contact with their kids. There's plenty that we know about.
So
that.
You're saying if the mother says to a child, your dad left me for another woman, the child says to dad, Mommy says you have a girlfriend and you left us for another woman, dad is not supposed to say that's not true?
The most important thing is to be empathic with the child. That creates a receptivity to what you then follow up with, which is, you know, there's more to it than that, and when you're ready, I can try to explain it. And you don't let the child sort of bully you into defending yourself. You can say, you know what? I think you're too upset right now. I don't feel like this is the right time. When you're ready, when you can be respectful and I really feel like you're ready, then we can have a conversation.
Well, let's do the 7. Let's go over those 17, don't you think, Jill? I'm dying to hear what they are because I want to be able to look for them in testimony that I hear.
Well,
they are
available in a paper that is on my website called Beyond the High Road, Responding to 17 Parental Alienation Strategies Without Compromising Your Morals or Harming Your Child. But the reason is I really want to reassure parents that the advice I'm giving them is the high road. The high road in the case of alienation means being creative and proactive in protecting your relationship in a way that does not denigrate the other parent but allows the child to come to the truth. So I'll give you another example. If you mail letters to your child, and you're pretty sure the other parent is throwing them out. And again, this is under the situation where you still have contact. I have advice for parents who have no contact. These are the kids going back and forth, and the child is moderately alienated, and there's a lot of conflict and tension, but you still have access to your child. So a lot of parents under those circumstances will send gifts to their child at the other parent's house, especially if you happen to be a non-custodial parent and you don't get to see your child all that often. But everything you send goes into a black hole. So you know what you do? The next time you have your child with you, you go and buy some little things and put together a care package with your child. And then you throw in something the child doesn't see. And you tell them, oh, I've got a little surprise in this box. And you decorate the box, and you take it to the post office together, and you mail it to the child at the other house. Then the child will be motivated to get his or her mail. He's going to ask the other parent, where's that package? Where's that package? The parent can't throw it out then. And in the meantime, you never say to your child, see, I'm sending you things. You don't have to do that because then you're bad-mouthing the other parent. But the most important thing, the primary alienation strategy is bad-mouthing, right, denigrating the parent. It's always one of three things. She never really loved you. For dad, he had an affair, he stole the money. But when you boil it all down, there's only three messages. The other parent is unsafe, unloving, and unavailable. And in most cases, kids are getting all three messages. From a targeted parent's point of view, is to be loving, be safe, and be available. And that is not easy. That means to soccer practice, even if your kid's going to ignore you. It's being there to show how much you love your kid.
Amy, how do you, as a parent, how do you deal with the feelings of frustration that envelop you when you're trying to take the high road, and every day is a different scenario of disrespect and eventually silence? Is there a way to deal with the frustration that you feel? How do you combat that?
The main thing is to see your child as a victim. And if you truly understand that your child's mind has been kidnapped and their moral compass is being warped and the child is being denied the love and safety and good feeling of you, that parent that loves that child, then you see past the nasty, angry persona that your child has adopted. You have to truly get it, and it's a major psychological epiphany. You stop being angry at them. That doesn't mitigate the pain from the loss. It's easier to feel angry and bent out of shape at your kid than to feel the loss.
It's so important for you to point that out, because there's so many people that I talk to every day that are blaming their children. We know that it's not the child causing the problem, and that the hearts, minds, and souls of these children have been used as weapons against the target parent. And so it's so important to know that it's not them and not to blame them. And I always encourage people to have some focus. And for me, it was advocacy in joining different groups and being on board of PAAO and trying to get legislation changed. And there's so many ways to channel that energy, the sadness and the devastation that you feel. And I think it's important that people understand that and have a great support system as well.
I've had many people in my courtroom when there's alienation. The case comes to me after the divorce in some cases, and the parent has just given up because it's just too painful, the constant rejection. And I'm wondering, what can we tell these parents who are on the verge of giving up, that it's just too difficult? Is there resources? Is there therapy? Is there support groups? What can we tell them to keep them hanging in there?
Right. Well, you know, there's yes, 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 yes to all of that. There are support groups. I have helped start support groups all around the country for targeted parents, and anybody who wants to know where a support group is can send me an email, and I'll introduce them to other parents in their town or at least their county. And so that is definitely something I've done. There's wonderful internet support groups out there. They're linked on my website. I think there's a really helpful metaphor that I give to parents. And from the parents' point of view, they have like a loaf. If you think of like a whole big warm loaf of bread, whole loaf of love to give to their child. But all they have an opportunity to give their child is like a crumb. When you're a targeted parent, right, you sort of can maybe wave to your child from the, you know, from the soccer stands, and maybe your child will see it. And maybe you'll get like a little smile from your child. So few opportunities to give all the love that you have, all the nurturing and the guidance, and all of that is cut off. And so from the targeted parent's point of view, they feel like it's just a crumb. It's nothing. Why bother? But from the child's point of view, that crumb is everything, because it's the difference between knowing that the parent loves you and not.
I have a question for you. Problem I see that a lot of energy is spent on what to do with PAS once it's manifested, but very little is spent discussing ways in which it can be prevented or minimize the potential of it being manifested through policy. Dr. Baker, I was wondering if you have any feelings about, any issues about that. What can be done to minimize the potential of PAS being manifested? Because if you're dealing with narcissistic personalities, there's very little that can be done.
Well, I actually have a thought about that.
Policymakers are currently discussing not PAS per se, custody and visitation and things like that. So don't you think that policy set in those areas leave the door open or less open for PAS? So what needs to be done in that area of policy on minimizing the potential for PAS?
Yeah, two separate but important questions. One is policy and one is strategy for the parent, right?
Not for the parent.
No, but parents, I think we could offer answers to both parts of that, because
absolutely,
parents need to be empowered with some strategies themselves. But
right.
Dr. Baker, can you talk about policy and what you think about, you know, expanded rights for the non-custodial parent, whether or not that would be a disincentive for an alienator?
Well, I think my interest in prevention has not been on the policy end. It's been on empowering and educating children, not just targeted parents. You know, I've been talking so far about this paper that I wrote for targeted parents, which has advice for them. The piece that we've been missing is that these kids are out there, and as long as they have any contact with an alienating parent, let's say it's a dad who thinks that he's the targeted parent and he wants to get 50%, that kid is still with the alienating parent 50% of the time. So even that policy change would not be enough in and of itself to stop alienation. So what I've been thinking about is what we can do to help kids develop critical thinking skills, because that's what gets eroded. Each of these 17 parental alienation strategies erodes the child's ability to see the targeted parent for who that parent really is. It undermines the child's ability to know his or her own truth, which then leaves the door open for the alienating parent to put a different spin on things, right? His or her own truth, the bad-mouthing truth, the pro-brainwashing truth.
So Dr. Baker? You're saying there are actual strategies that we can tell listeners to help children from minimizing that black and white thinking.
Well, I've developed a children's book and a workbook and a school-based program, which is being implemented in a few schools we just started this past year. And it takes each of the parental alienation, each of the 17 strategies, it presents it as a situation. We call them family situations. What do you do when mom or dad looks sad when you're about to go be with the other parent? And we want to give kids the tools for dealing with each of them. And the way that we've decided to do that is both in a book that a therapist or a parent could read individually to the child, or the child could read to him or herself, and most importantly, a school-based program where kids can learn from each other how to resist the pressure.
Could you give an example of what it would be if they said, don't tell your dad I'm doing this?
What the book does is it teaches the kids four approaches for each of the 17 situations. And the approaches are thinking for yourself, considering your options, listening to your heart, and getting support. That we want the kids to always think, what do I know is true? Am I being pressured to think something bad about a parent, or do I actually think that's bad myself? So that's the critical thinking. So it's, what do you do if mom says something that's mean and untrue about dad? Well, the book teaches the kids how to take that thing that's being said and look at it and to ask themselves, have I seen that myself? Or am I just hearing mom say it about dad or hearing dad say it about mom? Have I seen it myself? Am I free to have a different idea than what I'm being told? Or do I have to agree with that parent? So that's an example. So there's exercises and games and role playing that the kids do to help them develop those critical thinking skills.
Who do they work with that workbook? I mean, is that with a targeted parent or how do they do that?
In the schools, the program is run by a social worker or a school psychologist. It's a 20-week program. They take a different family situation, and they work on critical thinking skills, considering their options, listening to their heart, and getting support around that particular situation.
My question is, I would like to know probably everyone's opinion on this one, on what everyone thinks about dropping child support. I did so hoping that the bad-mouthing would stop, but it never did. But on the flip side, if I pursue to go after the support, it would probably make things worse. And I want to know what y'all think about that.
Good question.
Tricky one, isn't it?
It's a tricky one, but it's the most common question you can imagine. You have a family. They're going along okay. The mother, let's just use that as the example, although by no means it goes both ways this time.
Sure.
But let's just say the mother knows that the dad's making more money, wants to go in for an increase. Things are pretty simpatico. The minute she goes to court for an increase, it's going to cause a dissension. Child could pay the price, right?
Right.
Child's doing okay. We want to always protect the child. The child has the right to the best lifestyle that they can have. It's never really a good idea to do things because of intimidation. Clean is clean. If you're entitled to more, you write a lovely letter saying, I know that pursuant to statute that I have the right to an increase. I appreciate all the child support you've given me. And we do need a little more. We have soccer practice. We have the band. We have all these things. I don't want to go to court. That's the last thing I want to do, and you don't want to. And the statute provides for, can we work this out so that we can continue to protect our child as we have done?
But,
yes,
right?
I'm talking about outright defiance of court orders. I'm talking
right.
about...
Oh, you're talking about collection.
Excuse me?
You're talking about collecting arrearages.
Yes, an old court order that was never upheld, and let's say that if I would start, I had to get a withholding of garnishment orders. They would kick in, the jobs would change in order not to pay it. I would find out where he worked again, he would pay it. But here's what's odd, is he picked him up like clockwork, but he refuses to pay any child support. So I just let it go, because I was always told and taught, if you go back to court, it makes things worse. And it does, especially
if
I don't need the money, but it's the principle of the matter.
No, there's no principle. There's no principle when it comes to protecting your children.
So you're saying that I should just let it go?
If you don't need the money and it's going to adversely affect your children and you don't need the money and you know that he is going to do A, B, or C, and D and it's going to crush your children, is there really a choice? I mean, this is not a legal answer. It's not a legal answer. It's not a legal question. Legally, you can and you can get it. You can put a lien on real estate, whatever you can do. But if you know that it's going to cause an earthquake and that your children are fragile, and your children are fragile, what's more important? That's your question.
No, you're right.
And that's a judge talking. And that's you wouldn't expect me to give that answer.
Well, and that's kind of what I suspected, and I've asked several people this answer, and I've kind of got the same one. I think it's just a little, because he's, quote, I guess, getting away with it. You know, it's more in your face.
Well, let's hear what Dr. Baker has to say, because, you know, maybe Dr. Baker.
He outright defies all the orders. I mean, no health insurance.
In a study that I did of about 70 targeted parents about their satisfaction with their legal representation, and the last question of the survey was, you know, when all was said and done and rights were afforded to you in the final order, were they enforced? I tend to think it makes sense to play it safe. Why poke a sleeping tiger?
Right.
You can live without the money and let it. The most important thing, though, is to be at peace with your decision. Do not let it eat you up. Because
on that aspect, I've taken the high road, so to speak, and I kind of suspected that's what everyone would say, and that's what I went along with, you know, because I know it would hurt the kids. But I think it's just such a shock that someone would, you know, ignore the court orders like that and just get away with it.
A court order
and not care.
No enforcement. There's no sanctions against people who are in contempt. You know, I'm not at all surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not either. It's just sad.
They get parenting time, and then it's not enforced. The court does nothing.
Yeah, and I have never withheld parenting time. I followed it right to a T. I'm a social worker.
You know, Monica, I got to tell you something. Because you do the right thing, because you are the right person, doesn't necessarily create the reciprocal behavior. You can only be the best person that you can be. But your behavior has to be right for you because you're doing it, not for any hope of compensation in their behavior. We never get that in life. It's not how the world took the way the world works.
Monica, we've talked about this time and time again, and for you to get to the level where you're not wanting to have that winning mentality is where you need to be. I think you're almost there, but you just said, I've asked time and time again this question to people, and I've gotten the same answer. How many times do you need to hear it until you hear the answer you want to hear?
I think it's just, I'm holding on to that justice aspect. I look at it like, well, I do all of the right things. I follow the law. I abide it.
It should be enough that you're capable to take the high road. That's its own gratification. And, you know, and there's shift in thinking. It's available for you to get. But if you don't, you're going to see yourself as the victim of somebody who just doesn't get treated as fairly as they do. And as long as you have the victim mentality in this, and you do, it's completely disempowering. So I have a question to ask Dr. Baker. A mother or father comes up for visitation. You know, everybody says, what am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to grab him and throw him into the car?
You mean what should the targeted parent do?
Yes.
Or what should the alienating parent do? Well, I really think it depends on what kind of relationship you had with your child up until this point, but I think it's very important to have an expectation, not a defeatist mentality, but an expectation that this is going to happen. So part of it is just a mindset into your car. And you have to say, if you get him to school, then you can get him to go with me, and that's all there is to it. You know, as we heard from the last caller, it's easy to get into that place where you just feel so helpless and victimized by the targeted parent, and you just have to keep thinking. You know, one thing that I always say is if you have a relationship with the kid, you could ask the child, How are we going to solve this? You got to come with me on Saturday. What can we do? You keep saying we, not what can I do. It's we. We have a problem. Our relationship is in a rocky place right now. What can we do to make it better?
I deal with so many people that have no contact with their children. And what I'd like to just touch on briefly is when you have no contact at all with your children, what continue the phone calls every day, every month, every week? How often is it okay to keep it up, and how long do you keep it up?
I would be calling that child every day, because that's how often you would be talking to your child if you had a relationship. And I think it's important to call your child at the same time every day. That's assuming you have a cell phone number, and I can talk about what do you do if you have no numbers. But assuming you have some way of contacting your child, I would call every day at, 4:15 or 5:30 or whatever, because it creates a sort of rhythm in the child's life. It puts you in the child's mind at that time. Oh, it's 4:30. I bet mom will be calling me now. So it's keeping the relationship alive. And, I know cases where every 6 weeks the kid will actually answer the phone. But it's also good to mix it up. So sometimes you send a text message. Sometimes you call and you email. And the most important thing when you're doing this contact is to be very warm and loving, and not angry, even though you might be totally angry, and not guilt-provoking, even though, of course, your child is breaking your heart, and on some level you want them to know. That's it. No guilt, no manipulation, just warmth and love. If your child is older, I wouldn't necessarily call every day. I would think, well, how often would I speak to my child if we had a relationship? And that's how often I would do it. Now, when you're sending an email, the most important thing about an email is, first of all, think about it, like, if the judge saw this email, would it look bad or stupid, right? So you kind of hold it above reproach in everything you do. And think about the header, because it's likely that the kid will delete the email and won't read the text, but the header will get into that child's brain, because you have to look at the header in order to know who the email's from before you decide to hit delete. So it should always just say something like, loving you, or mom's thinking about you, or happy Tuesday, love mom, or dad.
I've got a question for Michelle Lawrence, and I know she's involved with a little bit of what's going on in Illinois in terms of family law reform, and earlier it seems to have been said, well, maybe there's not much we can do in terms of policy change, but I want to throw a couple out and get a reaction. One is, in 2005, our state Supreme Court handed down rules of court mandating co-parenting classes. I think they took effect gradually, but kind of 2006, 2007. And now parents are required to 3 1-hour sessions on co-parenting if they were going through any kind of a divorce or separation of the children from the parents. However, I'm hearing back from parents routinely that some of these amount to nothing more than sit in a room, watch a videotape. Now they're being told, oh, you just go online. Oh, 2.5 hours is enough. They're being watered down, and there was nothing put in there to address parental alienation. I'm hearing that barely even addressed, and certainly not sufficiently in that context. So there's a tool right there that somebody could do something with to improve and to deal with parental alienation. The other thing, or child alienation, the other one is that in Illinois, one of the factors the judge is required to consider in the awarding of custody is what we call the friendly parent clause. And Judge Lawrence is familiar with that. And it's about the willingness, ability of the other parent to facilitate a relationship between the other parent and that child. What can we do there? What could be done to maybe make that a little more something that judges pay maybe closer attention to?
Okay, first of all, starting with the beginning, I didn't say that policy wouldn't make a difference. I don't believe that at all. I think policy would make a tremendous difference. If people didn't know that fighting would result in a benefit to them and that there was a certain amount of expectation that the non-custodial parent would have with that child, they would have a disincentive to fight. So I think policy would matter, actually. Now, in terms of one of the key factors in determining custody and visitation is who better facilitates the relationship with the other parent. It is so huge, because if you're going to give one parent amped up power over another, you have to know that they won't abuse that power. It's a major factor, and I think it's getting more impetus all the time, which parent would better facilitate. When I have people on the witness stand, I'm watching to see who maligns the other parent and who doesn't. Maligning the other parent is a really negative factor. Now, granted, in a custody case, you have to tell facts as you see them. But if you say to them, can you say something good about your soon-to-be ex-spouse, and they can't, that's important, too.
Mike, I think you know that in the Illinois Family Law Study Committee, things are being done every Saturday, every other Saturday, and we've been working for 3 years. And I think changing the laws and judicial reform are two things that can definitely make a difference as we change the culture of divorce in Illinois and across the country. But there are always going to be these narcissistic people who are going to employ this tactic of parental alienation no matter what we do. I mean, right now in Illinois, we have a visitation interference law that is not used at all. In anybody's case, it's almost never used. And it's unfortunate because it would alleviate a lot of the problems.
The potential alienator is terrified that they're going to lose their child. So what they do in response to that terror is try and disconnect the child from the other parent. And they do it for all the wrong emotional reasons. So if that variable was reduced, people wouldn't have to escalate painting the picture of the other spouse in the negative way. They wouldn't be afraid because it's a foregone conclusion that everybody's going to have a lot of contact with the child.
Well, when you
get a divorce, you don't start trying to put your thumb on the scale.
You know,
Amy, can you comment?
I agree in part with what you're saying, Judge, but I think it's ignoring or doesn't take into account the parents who do this to punish the other child. They're doing it out of a desire to exercise their power and abuse over the other parent, and they know the best way to hurt that parent is to steal the kid. The policy that I really would like to see is a policy that says that all divorcing parents have to be educated about parental alienation, because the best way to protect yourself is to know what it is up front. So that's one thing. I would love to see kids be mandated to be in my program, because it would teach them how to step outside the conflict. And I had another thought. Sanctions for parents who do not follow the court order. If there were automatic, immediate, specific sanctions for either parent, if they do not produce that child, if they do not, you know, we have very specific sanctions for parents who don't pay child support, and there's nothing like that. The sanctions to enforce the policy, that's what needs to happen.
You're absolutely right. There's a difference, and it got blurred for a minute. The difference is between somebody with maybe a personality disorder, an alienator, maybe narcissistic borderline, whatever it is, and court system-induced incentives to alienate. You're right. There is a difference, and that difference does matter, because if somebody wants to do it, it is so easy to sacrifice your child to get to the other parent.
Right.
To take a hit on them.
50 is not going to help you. It's a fantasy. It doesn't mean that some parents shouldn't have 50-50 custody. I'm not saying that. But I think it's a mistake to think that that is the solution, because it's not.
And I don't think that the people who are really lobbying for that believe it's a solution.
They definitely see it as something that evens the playing field, so that the targeted parent has a little better ability through access to counter the alienating parent and maintain a decent relationship with their child.
Yeah, well, you bring up a really important piece of this whole thing. You know what? It brings up what Jill was talking about and what Monica was talking about. You say to yourself, don't these people realize that they're going to destroy their child? Do they not see the blood on their hands? Dr. Baker, what can we say about people just not having this understanding? Would classes, teaching consequences, get through to the people who are willing to sacrifice a child's happiness?
No, the classes is for the targeted parent, to educate them about what alienation is so that they can see it sooner. That's the
okay.
only point, is to educate them so that if they don't figure it out before it's too late. If they can figure it out sooner, then they have a better chance of knowing how to react to it. They can do what they can to protect the relationship, and they can then hopefully, you know, go to court with a better case.
Amy, do you think this is a tactic that's being employed more now? I mean, when I look at my activism in the disability community, I can see that the disability community has changed over the last 20 years by leaps and bounds. But in this arena, do you see that parental alienation has grown in its use?
I don't think we know the answer to that. I think awareness is increasing, so it's a problem that more people, not enough, there's not enough awareness, but it's increasing. And so it creates a sense that the problem is getting worse, you know, just the way, you know, sexual abuse was in the 70s or, you know, physical abuse before that. Nobody talked about it. Nobody named it. And then all of a sudden it had a name and people were talking about it. And then it seemed like it was everywhere. Well, I don't think there was really more cases. I just think people were more willing to say that this happened to them.
Amy, do you still get the face when you talk about the words parental alienation? I know that I do when I you know, talk to people and just use that term. Their faces kind of get screwed up, look at me, and they don't really understand what it is. But when you explain, then they say, oh, yeah, my brother's going through this, or you find that as well?
Absolutely. I used to say I couldn't talk to 10 people with, you know, when I tell them what it is, where at least one of them, and sometimes it was all 10 of them, would say, oh, I had that as a child, or yes, my brother's going there. I went through, you know, what it, I think it touches so many people.
And I think what you said earlier is so important as well, is that it is not a gender issue. For so long as for the last 6 years that I've been working in this field, I thought I was lumbering under the impression that it was only men who were affected by it, even though I was an alienated mom. But when my book came out, I was getting email after email from women who were joint custody moms and non-custodial moms who were alienated and didn't want to speak out because of the stigma that's attached to being a mom without her kids.
Right. People think you must have done something to have your child reject you.
Yeah, yeah.
Kids don't reject, you know, good parents. We have this fantasy that kids are, they have a kind of healthy selfishness. They know which parent's going to make them knuckle down and do their homework and which one's going to take them to soccer practice. I mean, and that is just so far from the truth.
What about adult children that have grown, that live their whole life being alienated, and now they're trying to have relationships and trying to live a life? What are the long-lasting effects of parental alienation syndrome?
Well, what I found from the interviews that I did with the 40 adults who had this experience as a child, and that all of the people that I interviewed at some point in their life had the realization that they had been manipulated to reject a parent that they should not have rejected. So obviously I couldn't interview the people who hadn't yet had the experience. And what I found was that the long-term effects are surprisingly similar to the effects of being in a cult. So, for example, if somebody goes into a cult at age 18 and they come out at 28, they are not your average 28-year-old. Those 10 years in the cult stunted their development, warped their moral compass, distorted their thinking, undermined their critical thinking skills. Those are the same things. So the people that I interviewed talked about being depressed. They talked about hating themselves. And it's no surprise. They grew up thinking one of their parents didn't love them. They grew up knowing, not consciously, but feeling that the parent that they were allied with was only loving them in a very conditional way. Because the love of the parent that's favored is a very conditional love. It's conditioned on the child rejecting the other parent. So, of course, these kids grow up with very low self-esteem. And then when they figure it out and they realize how badly they treated the targeted parent, I mean, it's a terrible pain that they felt. You know, they feel that they're horrible people. They must have, you know, they must have just done horrible, horrible things.
Can you answer the question whether sooner or later the defensive wall that the children are forced to build, aided by their parent, must come down? Or can they go through the rest of their life? Or is that not answerable?
It's answerable in that I certainly interviewed people who had siblings who had not yet figured it out for themselves. And some of them were quite old, 60, 70 years old. So, and we know from targeted parents who are, you know, 70 years old and have, you know, grown kids who have not connected. I mean, it's terrible. I wish I could say to every parent, you will get your child back. All I can say is you might. We don't know. We don't know which child's going to come back, but we know that some of them do. And we know that the thing that makes the difference above everything else is continuing to tell your child, I'm here, my arms are open, my home is open, my heart is open. No questions asked. Come back.
Hi. I have a question for Amy, and it has to do with the conference that's coming up at Mount Sinai in October. I believe you're going to be part of that.
Right. Yes, it started out, this is one of a series of conferences that are called the Canadian Symposium on Parental Alienation Syndrome, because the first one was in Toronto, but then there was a second one, and this is the third, and this will be at Mount Sinai on October 2nd and 3rd in New York City.
and 9 leading speakers in the field of parental alienation will be at this conference.
And have you gotten any indication of the interest on the part of, you know, really the people in authority in the courts and the mental health professions that we really want to reach? Are they responding at all?
I don't know, because I'm not the person planning the conference. I am promoting it as best I can. It is interesting. Because I live in New Jersey, I decided to contact the organization in New Jersey that's in charge of all of the trainings for lawyers and judges. In New Jersey, it's the centralized organization that does all of the training. And I begged them to let me do a training on parental alienation. And they were so skeptical at first. They would only let me do a webinar. And then 40 people came, and it got rave reviews, and then they let me do a major half-day training, and also that got pretty good reviews, and people
Great.
Were very happy. But initially, they didn't even see the benefit at all of doing it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we're talking about how it's kind of possible that it's like the church elders coming to visit Galileo, who has his telescope set up, and, you know, about whether what's in the center of the universe. And we're guessing that a lot of people just don't want to know about it.
It's complicated because I think in general, I'm sure that you are an exception, but in general, it seems to me that judges like to think or want to think that it's a he said, she said, and both parties are to blame, and it's impossible to really tell if one is like really a victim and one is really a villain. And so,
well, and I think Amy too. It's most judges that are in family court are not qualified to be in family court. They some of them haven't even practiced in that arena, and they're sitting making decisions for children's lives that they shouldn't be making.
And alienating parents are like evil geniuses. You know, they're really good at presenting a
very
compelling, believable picture of themselves as the savior of the child, or I just wish Johnny would have a relationship with Dad. I just can't make it happen. You know, whatever. So the judges, in my experience, it's easier to think, or it's natural to think that it's the problem is 50-50. And then what you do is you just sort of say, oh, keep trying to work it out, rather than saying, you know what, one parent is really doing something actively wrong here, and I need to step in and fix this.
All right, let's talk about something really tangible, and let's talk about the family, the parent who starts to see the beginning stages of alienation, visitation becomes sporadic, Skype starts to be exchanged for live visitation. Let's see if we can create a protocol of some sort, random, you know, everything changes based on facts, of what people should do when they start seeing this happen vis-a-vis the courts. And I have an opinion, and I would love for Jill and Dr. Baker to weigh in on this so that people who are listening and really saying, I think this is starting to happen to me, I believe that they should start to file petitions and alert the judge and say, there are starting to be some behaviors that are very problematic. We urge the court to keep a close watch on this, because I've missed 5 visits, and more than just my visits. You got to let the judge know that you're not just worried about your stuff, but you think something's going on with the child, and you really want the court to pay attention.
And the thing that I would add to that is, if you can organize that petition along the 17 research-derived parenting behaviors that I call parental alienation strategies, then it looks more objective, and the more you have, the better.
Well,
so
that's
not,
a good,
you're not
that's
talking
good.
About bad mouthing and limiting contact. Strategy 1, here's my evidence for this. Strategy 2, here's my evidence for that. Bing, 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 all the way down. Because parents who do this do most of the strategies.
Jill, do you think that would have made a difference had you have known what was going on earlier, honestly?
I have to say, you know, when you're saying file documents, horrible thing for parents who are being alienated is to go into court and have a judge say, well, let's see how it, let's look at it in 2 weeks. Let's have a status call. I had 16 status calls. So the more time, if you have a judge that can't make a swift decision, the more time you allow that alienator to have with those kids, and I had joint custody of my kids,
mm-hmm.
you know, and a visitation schedule. So the more time you allow this guy to have or girl to have with your kids is the worse off you're going to be. And I, in my case, no, I don't think anything would have helped. I think I was up against a brick wall from the very beginning. You know, if there was a judge like you, then maybe. I think you just have to have the right lawyer. You have to have the right set of circumstances happening at the right time.
Or educate the judge.
Another thing that I've been thinking about is if the attorneys for the alienating parents said, you know what, this is not right. If they had a moral backbone, and I mean, when I gave my training to the attorneys, I looked at them, all 70 of them in the audience, and I said, at what point is vigorously advocating on behalf of your client child abuse? And you need to ask yourself that.
Well, I'm giving a training session to attorneys on the good karma divorce, and what that's going to have to do with is good karma lawyering. And at what point are we, as lawyers in the legal system, adding to the good progress of civilization? If we have families falling apart and we have a system and some lawyers that are making it worse, how is there a moral compass for people who are in the business of dismantling families? And I say there is. But there's one question I want to ask, because Jill and I have talked about this between ourselves. And is there ever any kind of dialogue that could go on where the targeted parent could sit down with the alienator parent that might help the situation? Is there should be those attempts ever made?
Well, that's point one in my paper, Beyond the High Road, because the number one parental alienation strategy is bad mouthing. And what I recommend is if you hear the other parent saying bad things about you to your kid, and believe me, you will, right? It's not all hidden. There's eye rolling and, I can't believe your mother made you whatever. I can't believe your dad, you know. The kids, a lot of this does get played out directly in front of the kids. And so what you do, this is my advice, is you go up to that parent and you say, you seem really upset with me. You know, I hear you saying some things. You must be really upset. You know, I have my own list of things that I'm upset about. How about if we try to work this out, you know, some other time when we're not standing in front of Johnny? Now, the reason I recommend that targeted parents do this is not because I think the other parent's going to say, yeah, let's go out for coffee and iron out our differences, because I think that's highly unlikely. But it puts you on record in front of your child that you have your list of complaints, but you're just not going to trot them out in front of the kid because you think that's wrong. So it's sort of shaming the other parent without actually...
So would the targeted parent be the last person in the world to say to the alienating parent, do you know the consequences of what you're doing? That the child will,
yeah,
you know, our child will not be able to have a satisfactory relationship, that she'll have a detachment problem.
That sounds so condescending. I've read emails back and forth between parents. What you're doing is harming your child. They've quoted my book. Your child will be dead. It sounds really self-righteous.
So how do they get the information to the other side if it's, will they have a relative or a grandmother? I mean, there's got to be a way.
You know, I think it's stressful for Johnny when we're fighting. What can we do to try to get along better?
How does someone send your book who's not the directly involved, that's not the targeted parent?
How does someone what? I missed.
You know, what's a good strategy for the alienating parent to receive your book in a way that they'll be open to it?
I don't. If they're really an alienating parent, they won't be.
They won't. That's exactly
right. But
I'm
talking about the ones who are alienators but really would never want to hurt their children if they understood how badly it was going to happen.
Well, you as the judge, I think, have some power to say, I think you need to read this book. I think it's, you know, I recommend that you think seriously about the impact of what you're doing. But between one parent to the next, I mean, the last person who's going to change the, you know, the alienating parent is the targeted parent. There's too much competition and animosity and one-upman.
Michelle, if you believe that the alienating parent doesn't get it, that's the wrong belief. Because they get it. They know exactly what they're doing, whether they're doing it, you know, at the first level of alienation or the most severe. They get it.
I think they get that they're really harming the other parent. I just don't know if they know the extent to which they're sacrificing their child's happiness.
I'm not sure they care. I mean,
yeah.
Nothing
yeah.
I've seen.
Let's talk about them then. Well, what kind of, how do these people become so obtuse? How does that?
Well, that's a personality disorder. That's sort of the hallmark of a personality disorder. It's characterological, so it shapes
their worldview and all of their relationships. It's a closed system. You can't really give them corrective feedback. I put my efforts into educating targeted parents and trying to help prevent this by working with kids. I think those are the three players involved, the kid, the alienating parent, the targeted parent. Two of them, I think, I have hope or working with. The alienating parent, I think, is, for me, a lost cause.
So developmentally, let's say somebody's listening and they're in a marriage and they would want to get out of the marriage but have a feeling that the person they're married to will be an alienator, okay? And they don't know when, and this is a really hard question. Maybe it's another unanswerable one, but what age group is the worst, and which ones have little less damaging effects?
It seems that every age group is vulnerable. I mean, and that's sort of unfortunate. You know, people used to think that by the time kids were teenagers, they really were smart enough. Of course, that never explained why all those kids were joining gangs, right, or doing drugs or dropping out of school. I mean, we know on some level teenagers are, like, at extremely high risk for risky behavior and bad outcomes. And so alienating parents step up the alienation, you know, strategies right around the time the kids are 12, 13, because they know that at that point the court is on their side. Denigrating the other parent, interfering and limiting contact, interfering with communication, that's the third one, interfering with what I call symbolic communication, that's not allowing pictures of the other parent and not talking about the other parent, withholding information about the child, changing the child's name. Moms do that by using their maiden name as the last name. Dads do it by coming up with a new nickname for the child. It's a very powerful strategy. Calling the new spouse mom instead of stepmom or dad instead of stepdad. Asking the child to keep secrets from the other parent. Asking the child to spy on the other parent. Those are the ones that come to my mind. But they're in my paper called Beyond the High Road. It's on my website on the homepage. It says Advice for Parents. And then from they're also presented in a kid-friendly format in my book called I Don't Want to Choose, How Middle School Kids Can Avoid Choosing One Parent Over the Other. And that's available on Amazon and on my website. And again, it doesn't just list them. It teaches kids what to ask themselves. What do you ask yourself if mom asks you to spy on dad? What do you do as a kid? So it helps the kid come up with the answers.
This whole thing with your list has also to do with putting the child in the loyalty bind. I guess that's even a more prevalent thing in all divorce cases.
Right, and that's why we don't talk about parental alienation when we talk about this book. We talk about it as helping kids step outside the loyalty bind, because that everybody can sort of get that, you know, that it's hard for kids to maintain a good feeling about two people who now don't love each other and might even be in great conflict with each other. So even if there's not parental alienation going on, kids feel a loyalty conflict and they're still thrown into these situations and they need help so that they can step outside. Otherwise, they're going to choose one parent over the other.
I was just going to say that I see all the time children that it's prevalent in almost every divorce case I see where the child feels guilty for how much they love the other parent.
Right.
Not in really happy divorces, and they do exist, thank goodness, but in generally the conflictual ones without the out-and-out alienators, it's just too irresistible for so many parents to try and get a leg up on loyalty and affection.
And the truth is it's hard for kids to maintain that tension. And so even if the parents were, you know, even if they're not out and out, you know, obsessed alienators, they're still doing things that create in the child a feeling that the child should choose. And our message in this book is you don't have to choose. You don't want to choose. You want to have a relationship with both parents, and you don't have to choose, and we're going to teach you how to not choose.
Amy, what is a child feeling when they are alienated? Are they feeling deep down love for the target parent? How the conflict that's going on inside, the loyalty to the alienating parent, what is their feeling towards that target parent other than the obvious animosity? What's really going on?
Well, I do believe in levels of consciousness. So I, you know, and that certainly was borne out in my research, where the people I interviewed said I said horrible things to my parent that I was rejecting, and I even believed it, but on another level, another part of my mind, I knew that it wasn't true. And so
you know, there's like a little seed of doubt that these kids have where they can sort of sometimes remember that the parent that they're treating so horribly really doesn't deserve it and really was an okay parent. But it's sort of like it's buried. You know, the metaphor that I use for parents is those Russian nested dolls, the little doll inside the doll inside the doll. And like that little tiny, tiny, tiny one, that's like the true, real child who loves you. And then there's these wooden layers, these hardened, false beliefs that encase the child in anger and hatred and rejection. But I do believe that deep inside, if you had a good relationship with your child before the alienation began, then that is still in there and your child's...
Dr. Baker, I'm sure you're aware that there's a big controversy right now regarding the inclusion of PAS in the new upcoming edition of the DSM-5. And I know also, and this is could be a big stumbling block, is that in some states, I think California comes to mind, where the bringing up PAS as testimony is not going to be allowed.
Yep, I'm certainly aware of that, and I am one of the authors on the proposal to have PAS accepted into the DSM. So I'm fully aware
what's
of that.
What's the status on that?
Well, the book isn't coming out until 2013, and we've not received any feedback yet. I actually debated Janet Johnson and Peter Jaffe, myself along with Bill Burnet, at a conference in Denver.
In Denver,
1,000 people in the audience sort of debating should PAS be included. And it's interesting because even the people who I was debating who said, and these are the major opponents of the concept, not that they think PAS is bad, but they think it doesn't exist, even those people in the end said, you know, yeah, of course it exists. We just don't think it belongs in the DSM for this reason or that reason, which I don't think are valid reasons. But
don't you agree we need to have it included to give it more legitimacy in court?
It would help, and kids can get diagnosed, and people would
insurance.
Be trained in it, and the therapist could get reimbursed. I mean, I believe it is a syndrome. A syndrome is a cluster of behaviors with a common etiology. I think the 8 behavioral manifestations of PAS represent a true syndrome.
And how can people get involved in getting to that end with the DSM-5? How can they get involved in being an advocate? Can they write letters?
Well, there's a working group. There's a task force. There was a time when letters and input from the quote-unquote public were welcome. I don't know if that's still the case. It might be that the proposal is under advisement. But if you go to DSM and then the number 5, not Roman numeral like it used to be, but they changed it, DSM5.org, and you have to hunt around. It's not easy, but there's a tab that says conditions proposed by outside sources. Then you can register and log in and write a little letter to them saying that you think that this exists and should be included.
All right. My question has to do with the inclusion of the PAS in the next DSM would lend kind of a pathologizing aspect to what's happening in the kids. And then the next step would be clinicians suddenly medicating the kids, and it then becomes kids are the problem again, and the kids have the brunt, and the kids end up on meds forever. And as opposed to the court system doing something about the external pressures and problems and loyalty conflict, that's
I'm
worried about.
I really want to answer this. Because I've heard this before. Okay, so here's the answer. If asbestos causes cancer, right, we pretty much know that to be a fact, and the companies that create cancer are truly the cause, don't we still want to diagnose the individual so we can treat them? And then you go after the company that made the toxin. So it's not, you don't blame somebody because they have cancer. You say, oh, look, you have this horrible disease. Think about Munchausen by Proxy, right, where the parents are poisoning the child. Don't you still want to know that the kid's been poisoned so you can pump their stomach and treat them? You treat the problem. You have to treat the problem. And then you can also try to, you know, stem the systemic issue. But you're not protecting a child by pretending they don't have a problem. So that's just one thing. The other thing is, not everything that's in the DSM is medicated. There's a lot of conditions, like Down syndrome, that is in the DSM. And you want to know, oh, the child has an extra chromosome, and look, they have Down syndrome, and that has certain implications for their life, and we have to know what that is, but you don't just throw medicine at every problem. So not everything is medicated. And the truth is, if you believe that kids take on false beliefs distorted ideas, distorted feelings.
Amy, I'd like you to address some of the groups and organizations that are dead set against this happening and why.
Well, this caller made some of the arguments. Why label the child? You know, you label the person who has this. You know, if somebody shoots you with a gun, you want to say, oh, well, let's not label them as somebody who's bleeding. Let's not give them a bad label. You know.
Well, I want to thank you all. You have been absolutely tremendous. We are coming down to the end of the show, and I can't thank you enough to have us start Family Matters with Jill Ejizi.
Thank you.
Tonight we had Dr. Amy Baker, and we had Judge Michelle Lawrence. I can't thank you enough. You've been superb.